apparently, you know, the thinking Muslim audience are dubious people whom I shouldn't associate with. So this is very compelling, and there's a lot of other witnesses coming forward on this. The American government has just lied about that for the last many years. The only reason that didn't happen was I met a guy in Ghazni called Mohammed.
Since we last spoke, you've been to Afghanistan and you've pieced together some of the missing parts in this case.
It's a real challenge to get justice in America.
What is it about Afia that subjects her in particular to such awful treatment? How do the Taliban treat you?
You know, if you believe that, you believe in Santa Claus.
The case of Afia Siddiqui remains an open wound for all of us. It symbolizes the inhumanity and barbarism of US foreign policy. The incarceration of this brilliant academic and mother of three has become a marker of its excesses, of which there are many. She languishes in prison, serving an 86-year sentence for an offence that looks barely credible, the attempted murder of two US officials in Afghanistan in 2008. Her whereabouts before that date has been hotly contested, but her lawyers and activists have patched together the conspiracy surrounding Dr. Afia's ordeal. Sadly, the welfare of her younger son, Suleiman, who has not been seen since her detention in 2003, remains unknown. He's presumed dead. The last time I spoke to Dr. Afia's lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, he had returned from her prison in Fort Worth, Texas, where she had been reunited with her sister, Fauzia, for the first time in 20 years. If you haven't watched that program, I would highly recommend you do so to give you the backstory to this horrific case. Clive has just returned from a fact-finding mission to Afghanistan, and he has some considerable updates on Afia's case. Clive has helped secure the release of 86 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay and still acts for the remaining numbers. Since the early days of the war on terror, he has worked tirelessly to force the Americans and other Western powers to adhere to the rule of law. He has sought to uncover the secret prisons and ghost prisoners that stain the reputation of powerful states who present their wars in benevolent terms. Clive Stafford Smith, welcome back to The Thinking Muslim. It's great to have you here with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. And I must say your last program was very good. And I've got so many nice messages from so many nice people. So thank you.
On our last program, you requested a letter writing project, I suppose, for our viewers, where you requested that they write in letters that you would take because of legal powers you'd be able to take to Afia. I mean, how successful was that? Did that work?
Well, it was fabulous, actually. I got a lot in. What I do is people send me emails, yeah, and I just cut and paste them into a letter from me. Mm-hmm. And I sent her one letter, which was about 60 pages, so probably 200 people's letters.
Fantastic.
And I got that into her, and she really was thrilled because people say such awful things to her. And there she was with this massive letter from me, and yeah, she just got to read them back. Right. And I have another 72 pages now. But please don't let that slow you down. You know, I'll give you my better and newer email this time, if you don't mind broadcasting it.
Yeah.
And the more people send me, the better.
I'll put that email in the show notes, and we'll make sure we'll send a request out to our viewers to, right, to send that. How about the last time we spoke also, you were raising funds for the legal cover for her case. I mean, how's that going?
Well, again, actually, people were very generous to support the costs of the case.
Yeah.
It has had a certain repercussion on my nonprofit that I've now been blacklisted. Apparently, you know, the thinking Muslim audience are dubious people whom I shouldn't associate with. I'm proud to associate with you. And I'm going to litigate my blacklisting in due course. It's just a pain in the neck, you know. It's just one of these stupid things. They've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
And it's no joy, but we'll get around it.
Fantastic. Now, Clive, many of my viewers may not have watched the original show where you went into great detail about Afia's case from the very beginning when she was abducted in 2003 to today where she languishes in an American prison. Do you mind just giving us a quick summary of Afia's case for our new viewers?
Sure. Let me just hit the highlights or lowlights.
Yeah.
What sets Afia aside from all the other people I've represented over the last 20 plus years is that on March the 30th, 2003, she was abducted in Karachi with her three children. So she had six-month-old Suleiman, three-year-old Mariam, and six-year-old Ahmed. Mm. And they were all seized as they were driving to the airport, and she was just going to Islamabad from Karachi. And it appears that when they were seizing the four of them, they dropped the baby on its head, and that may have killed the baby. Yeah. And I always thought that must be the truth until I learned what happened to the others. So Mariam was taken from Karachi to Kabul, where she was forcibly adopted into a white American Christian family on the bizarre presumption that being a white Christian American was somehow superior to being a Pakistani Muslim of color. Yeah, just crazy, crazy. But at least, you know, there are those mad people who have that belief.
Yeah.
And it had happened in another case since then. But with Ahmed, the thing I just can't understand on any level is both Mariam and Ahmed were American citizens, and Ahmed was taken to Kabul, where age six, he was put in a prison.
Wow.
Now, I just can't fathom that. There's not even the sort of crazy rationale that there was with Mariam. And I've met with people in Kabul to prove that, and that's coming along. It's difficult to prove what was going on in these secretive places, but yeah. I've got a lot of good help on that. Then Afia was taken to Afghanistan herself, where she was tortured for 5 years.
Taken by?
By the U.S. Ah. So the U.S. had paid a bounty for Afia, $55,000.
Yes.
Which was happening to a lot of people at the time, yeah. But not to any other women, yes, in a high-profile case. The U.S. government has denied all along that she was in U.S. custody. That is risible, but we have to prove it. Sometimes we have to prove the sun rises every morning.
Yeah.
In this case, I have managed to prove it. It's been great in Afghanistan. I met a guy called Salim Kuche, who was just a lovely guy. He means nomad, his name. And he was clearly someone who disobeyed all the American rules when he was in custody himself in Bagram.
Yeah.
He was up in isolation in the cells on the second floor. And she was, Afia was in the cell next door, and he got to be able to communicate to her.
Yeah.
So he was the one who first heard about this. And then while I was sitting talking to Salim in the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, I don't want you to think it's terribly grand. It's not. It was grand in 1960, but not since then.
Yeah.
But I like the people there. And I was sitting there, and the governor of Panjshir comes by, and really nice guy, speaks good English, and came to say hello. He then turns to Salim and says, oh, I haven't seen you since Bagram. And it turns out that Salim came downstairs to the cage they were being held in and told the governor about Afia being upstairs.
Yeah.
The governor and others then told those four guys who escaped from Bagram, who then recorded the video about it back in 2005. So this is very compelling, and there's a lot of other witnesses coming forward on this.
How did they know it was Afia in the cell?
Well, but she said so. She only spoke English and Urdu, but they could communicate.
Yeah.
And so that's very important, mm-hmm, because the American government has just lied about that for the last many years.
Yeah.
And they've lied to everyone. They haven't just lied to, you know, the Pakistani people. They've lied to their own prosecutors in their trial. They lied to the judge. They lied to the jury. So that's very important. Then the other thing is, so she's then let out of Bagram when they finally discover that she's really not a nuclear bomb maker. They let her out, but what we've discovered is this. By then, her sister Fauzia, who is a fabulous woman who has a, you know, she's a neurologist, she's incredibly well-educated. If I ever get in trouble, I want Fauzia to be my sister because she's been great. She had stirred up so much publicity for Afia and the kids by 2008 that this was a huge embarrassment.
Yeah.
Mainly to the Pakistan government. The Americans honestly wouldn't care.
Yeah. Why an embarrassment to the Pakistan? Because they...
They were the ones who sold abducted her. So it was President Musharraf's people who sold her, and he was still in power at the time. So it seems clear. I'm not going to name names on your program, but I think I've now able to prove that there was a conspiracy to make sure that Afia and Ahmed were killed.
Right.
And the way it was planned was this. She was put on a bus from Kabul to Ghazni. She was told she could have her daughter Maryam back if she went to Ghazni and sat outside this mosque. She was given this boy who, you know, she'd been tortured for 5 years. She wasn't sure if it was Ahmed or not. It was Ahmed, but Ahmed had been threatened for 5 years that if he ever said he was Ahmed Siddiqui, they would kill him. So even he wouldn't tell his mum that it was him. But they're on a bus together going to Ghazni to get the daughter in theory, but that's not what's going to happen.
Right.
This is all designed for her to be killed as a suicide bomber. They've dressed the child up in a jacket with four big pockets with big bits of fruit in it.
Yeah.
It's July the 17th, 2008. It's the middle of summer. He doesn't need a jacket.
Yeah.
But the jacket is obviously designed to look like some sort of suicide jacket. She's in a full chador, so you can't see what's on underneath.
Yeah.
Someone is called in, a call to say that the suicide bomber is sitting outside the mosque. And then all the cops show up with their AK-47s, and they're just going to shoot her. The only reason that didn't happen was I met a guy in Ghazni called Mohammed Ajmal Mohammadi, just a delightful guy. He was a tailor right across the street from the mosque.
Yes.
And he'd seen this woman sitting there. She was there for 7 hours or so.
Right.
And he'd seen her there. People had gone up and tried to talk to her, but she only spoke Urdu and they all spoke, you know, Farsi or whatever.
Yeah.
And so he went out in the end and he spoke Urdu because he had been a tailor doing his trade around Pakistan. And he talks to her and says, you know, it's getting dark, it's a war zone, you really shouldn't be out here, you could go stay with my mother or whatever.
Yeah.
That's when the police show up. And when they're going to shoot her, this man stands between her and the guns and says, you've got it all wrong. And I have so much respect for that guy. He saved Afia's life. So they don't shoot her. They take her into custody. They then take her to the police headquarters. Now, this is where it all gets very interesting. They say, the Americans say, that she was being held at the Afghan National Police headquarters.
Yeah.
When they came and they came into the room where she was behind a curtain, and one of the soldiers put his M4 rifle on the ground. Yeah. You know, if you believe that, you believe in Santa Claus. But at any rate, she supposedly snatches up the M4 rifle and starts shooting at them, as if she'd know where the safety catch was. Do you know where the safety catch is on an M4?
I'm afraid not.
No, you're not a great terrorist there. No. So neither do I, by the way. I do now because I went and checked one out.
Yes.
But they say she was trying to shoot two Americans. It's total nonsense. There's no gunshot residue on her. Her fingerprints are not on the gun. There's no gunshot residue on the curtain. They say there are two bullet holes in the wall, but we checked that out, and actually there's a video of the wall earlier in the day, and the two holes are up there. There's no bullets in the wall. Mm. There's no shell casings. There's no nothing. So that's a lie.
Yeah.
What really happened was that she was in that room behind the curtain, hears American voices, and thinks, oh, my goodness, they're going to take me back to Bagram. She peeks around the curtain. One of them sees her and says she's on the loose and shoots her. There had just been another incident where a soldier had been accused of killing someone without justification and had been put on a criminal trial.
Yeah.
So they're all very paranoid about that. So they make up this story. But she was meant to be dead, and they were going to plant this evidence on her. And I always thought that was probably true, but I didn't have any proof. I do now.
Yeah.
Because they say that she had on her a bag with some proof about nuclear weapons, some proof about biological weapons. Well, I met the police officer who wrote an inventory of what was in her bag when she was arrested.
Yeah.
And his inventory says women's clothing, no mention of, you know, all this other stuff. But we now have, and also the Americans said in her trial that the governor of Ghazni brought all the material of nuclear weapons and so forth and showed it to the Americans and gave it to them, which I always thought was pretty weird because you don't do that in a criminal case. Yeah. I met the governor of Ghazni. He gave me a sworn statement saying this is nonsense. The guy who says it, I don't even know who he is. I didn't have any of the evidence. But now we've also got evidence of another person who was on the bus with Afia with a bag which clearly contained all of that material. And what was going to happen was they were going to shoot Afia and her son. They were then going to plant this material on her, and then the story in the Pakistan media would have been evil Al-Qaeda woman going to blow herself up with her son.
Yeah.
What an evil person, you know, she was killed. That was what was meant to happen.
But when you say they, are we talking about the Americans? We're talking about Pakistanis, the Afghan government at the time? Who were we talking about?
The Afghan government had nothing to do with it. No, I'm not going to name who it is because they know who they are. Right. I know who they are.
Yeah.
But part of this is about convincing the people behind this that if they'll just go along with us getting justice for Afia, no one needs to know about it.
Okay.
Who they are. But on the other hand, if they don't, I'm going to have to disclose it.
Yes.
And I should say, I just want to make this very clear, that there are people in Pakistan to this day who are threatening the family of Afia, including her sister, her children. It's not going to do you any good. I'm representing Afia, right? It's not, what I do is not their fault. Those people, again, I'm not naming them, abducted Afia's sister not long ago and put a hood over her head to try to convince her that she should stop trying to get justice for her sister.
Recently, this was recently. Really?
I'm not here again to speak for Fauzia. Yes. I have great respect for that woman. But I've told her, and I want to tell everyone else, that I'm Afia's lawyer. I'm not Fauzia's lawyer. So what I do is not Fauzia's fault.
Yeah.
If they want to abduct someone, they can abduct me. I don't really care. I'm old enough that I've had a good life. But they shouldn't be doing that to the family. That's just very wrong.
Yeah. So let me get the picture. So since we last spoke, you've been to Afghanistan and you've pieced together some of the missing parts in this case. So the big discovery you've made is there's a couple of discoveries, but it seems to me that you're convinced that there was a conspiracy to kill Afia in 2008 outside that mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And they would plant evidence on her in order to implicate her in some sort of suicide mission. And then the narrative would be sown that Afia was part of this greater terrorist conspiracy. How convinced are you of the plausibility of people like Mohammadi and others that you've met?
Mohammadi is absolutely telling the truth. And, you know, I should say I've got a lot of statements from a lot of people.
Really?
I've been there twice now, and I'm going to go back again in late April.
Yeah.
And it's not just the people I'm mentioning to you. I've got statements from a number of other people. There are six people who witnessed what happened.
Yeah.
Six people I got statements from. There are probably more. What happened outside the mosque, there's 200 people who were in the police headquarters who witnessed all of that.
Wow.
And then there were many, many people in Bagram and the other places. So we'll have a lot of evidence. We've already got a lot.
Yeah.
But there are problems in the American system. If you don't get justice early on in the U.S. system, it's quite hard to get it.
Mm.
I'm going to America in 2 days to bring back the wife of one of my clients who was sentenced to death 38 years ago.
Yeah.
I've proven exactly who did it. I've got a judge at one point issued an order saying that he was innocent, but that's not enough to set him free in the American system.
Yeah.
And his wife, who's 84, I'm going to go pick her up and bring her back to come and live with me and my wife in Dorset because she's just been through enough. So it's a real challenge to get justice in America.
Yes.
But we will. But we've also got to look at the broader picture, which is how to get better treatment for Afia in the meantime.
So we'll come to Afia's current situation, where she is now in Fort Worth in Texas. But just so that I understand what you're piecing together here, Well, actually, why are you peace investigator? What's the ultimate end? Are you trying to seek redress in the courts for Afia based on the statements that you're compiling?
Well, there are various things that we need to do. One is I want to challenge her conviction and her sentence.
In the U.S. courts.
In the U.S. courts, yeah. In the Southern District of New York. The judge was a guy called Judge Berman, and he was lied to. And he imposed this 86-year sentence on the premise that Afia was wandering around as an al-Qaeda terrorist for 5 years, where we can now prove that, no, she was being tortured in U.S. custody.
Yeah.
Right now, as things stand, she is facing more time in prison than Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is in Guantanamo, and as I'm sure you know, is accused of being the person behind 9/11. Now, you know, the chances are that he won't do as much time as Afia, because he's getting mitigation on his sentence because it's now conceded that the Americans tortured him.
Yeah.
And so the same should clearly happen to Afia, even if they don't accept that she's innocent, as they should do.
Yes.
She should get mitigation of her sentence because of what she's been through. And I think everyone, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, would agree that she's been through worse than he has because of her children and what happened to them. So that's one line. I'm going to go back to court in New York to do that. But then at the same time, I'm aiming towards clemency as well. Mm. Biden is up for re-election on November the 5th.
Yes.
On November the 6th, we'll know if it's President Biden or President Trump.
Yeah.
My bet is it will be President Trump. Mm-hmm. That means that Biden has 10 weeks between then and Trump taking office in January the 21st.
Yeah.
And in those 10 weeks, he can do justice. And we need to get through to him through people I know, but also through high-powered Pakistani Americans, in order to get the message across that they should settle this. And I think I mentioned to you before, and it's still my goal to engineer a prisoner swap between her and Shaquille Afridi, who was the guy who helped the Americans kill bin Laden. Mm. The Americans want him, the Pakistani, or at least 98% of the Pakistanis want Afia. So if we can engineer that swap in November, that'll be good.
And have you made any progress in engineering that swap between the two?
Well, I've met with some congressmen and senators' staffers to try to set that in motion. And we've got this really great judge in Islamabad who's been ordering the Pakistan Ministry of Foreign Affairs to basically do their job and help me.
Yeah.
And so they are now working with me to try and get political influence in America to engineer that swap. I hope we can do it. It's a lot of work, but there we go.
Earlier on, you mentioned that she's been treated far more harshly than most Guantanamo detainees like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Why? Like, what is it about Afia that subjects her in particular to such awful treatment in the hands of the Americans?
Well, I mean, look, there was a time when Guantanamo would rank as one of the worst prisons in the world.
Yeah.
I brought the very first case against Guantanamo in 2002.
Yeah.
And over the last 22 years, we forced the United States to treat people much better in Guantanamo. Right. And while it's not a Caribbean holiday camp, I mean, it is my holiday camp. I've been there 42 times. but I love going there because I like to meet the people. But it's a much better place in many ways than the prison that she's in.
Really?
Because FMC Carswell, there's just no oversight of it. There have been 13 guards convicted of raping prisoners in Carswell in the last few years. And Afia has been on the receiving end of both rapes and sexual assaults. And I've brought a complaint to the Bureau of Prisons, which they're investigating, about what's happened to Afia. But that's on top. And it happens all the time. It happens routinely. And that's on top of being in prison. She's being abused in prison all the time. So we've got to stop that, and that's quite a challenge.
So why has this been allowed to continue for so long? You know, she's been in prison since 2008, and you said it, you suggested last time, and you've confirmed it here again, that she's been treated awfully in prison. Like, what's allowed that to continue for so long?
A big part of it is there's no spotlight. You know, it is the spotlight of attention that gets people to behave in these places.
So that does work, the attention.
Well, it works somewhat. I mean, they're still horrible places.
Yeah.
But the reason all of this sexual abuse goes on is no one's challenging it. And they annoyed me one time. I've been to see her 8 times now.
Yes.
And one time they made me wait for an hour, and I was annoyed because I had better things to do than sit there. And so I looked through their visitation log, and they'd only had 4 legal visits for almost 1,000 prisoners, 976 prisoners, 4 legal visits since I'd last been there.
Wow.
At that rate, each prisoner is going to have 1 legal visit every 80 years. And this is why people get away with doing such bad stuff. Yeah. As you give people power, they tend to abuse it. And it's really important to have people like me there to say, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And so it's a real challenge. They have no imam in the whole prison. There's no one to be there as her spiritual guidance or whatever.
Yeah.
They don't have any doctors who can see her because, you know, she's a conservative Muslim woman. She's not going to just, you know, undergo strip searches all the time. So she's getting no medical care. She's getting no religious solace. So we've got to force those issues. But it's shocking to me that they haven't been forced long ago.
When we last spoke, you had just returned from a visit where Fawzia, her sister, for the first time had been able to meet her at that prison. I think I remember you suggested that that had really helped Fawzia's state of mind. I mean, what is a general state of mind since then?
Well, Fawzia was there. It was rather sweet. I was there for the whole of the meetings just to make sure it happened.
Yes.
And that I butted out and just let these two sisters talk, and they ended up singing nursery rhymes that they used to sing on the school playground. And that was great. It was at some level very traumatic for both of them. I mean, for Fawzia, because she was seeing her wonderful, intelligent younger sister treated that way. For Afia, because she was seeing her sister for the first time in 20 years. And Afia is sort of frozen in time.
Right.
When she thinks of her children, she thinks of them at age 6 months, 3 years, and 6 years. And it's very difficult for her to think otherwise because she's had all of this trauma.
Yeah.
So I got Fawzia to go another time. We went again in December. And this was a bit of a disaster. I mean, the first time I flew to Dubai and flew with her into America, and so everything went smoothly. I thought we'd sort of potty trained the U.S. government a bit, so she was safe to go by herself. No, she was stopped at the airport and forced to sit there for 4 hours while they determined whether she was a terrorist or not. Yeah. Then when we got to the prison, the first day I took her in, and I was just going to leave her there to meet with her sister. And you just don't know whether to laugh or cry. They couldn't find the key to the visitation room in the prison. You know, can you imagine being in a prison, they can't find the key?
Yeah.
So her whole visit was cancelled, having come, 13,000 kilometers. I managed to get her in a couple of other times for meetings at a cost of, I couldn't see Afia for those times. But it's just a mess. And Fawzia was very upset by the whole thing, and so we've been litigating to force the U.S. to treat her better next time. So I hope to take her back, sometime over the summer, because I think it's very good for everyone.
Great. You've been to Afghanistan now on a couple of occasions on your fact-finding mission. You're trying to find out about the detail of Afia's arrest and the horrific things that happened there at Bagram and elsewhere. I suppose my question about your visit to Afghanistan is it's obviously a changed place since the Americans left. Did you have any worries, or do you have any worries about your security when you arrived, and how did the Taliban treat you, for example?
Look, I've lived in America. I don't have any concerns about Afghanistan.
Right.
I mean, look, I went to Afghanistan on another Afghan prisoner from Guantanamo's case back in 2017.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. You couldn't do anything.
This is during the American occupation.
When the Americans were there.
Yeah.
Now it's fine.
Really?
And it was interesting. We should do a whole program on Afghanistan at some point because it was very, very eye-opening. The government were great. Half of them have been in Guantanamo, so they really understand what this is about, which is more than you can say for the British government or the Americans. The security is absolutely fine. They were really nice to me, and they insisted I should have security along with me, but it's totally unnecessary. In fact, I told the security guy, I said, look, I'm going to Texas next week. I need you to come there, not here. There's a real disconnect between Afghanistan and the West. And one thing actually I wanted to try to help them on is get American lawyers to represent them. Because, for example, there's $8 billion of Afghan money frozen by the Americans for the American victims of the Afghan war. Well, I think there's a lot more Afghan victims of the Afghan war. But the current Afghan government, I think, doesn't understand how to deal with the West in that way. And I had interesting conversations about what the perception is in the West. And you look at Britain or you look at America, there's only one perception, which is the Taliban are a bunch of maniacs and they treat women badly and so forth. I don't disagree that we need to treat women better than I think are currently, or in a different way, shall we say, than is currently happening in Afghanistan. I'm all in favor of women's education, and obviously. And there are plenty of people in Afghanistan who would agree with that. But what we're doing in the West is we're so vilifying the people in authority there that we're not having a discussion in the same language. And it's very interesting to hear the side of some of the people I talked to there. Because I would say, you know, I wasn't trying to rubbish them for not having women's education. That's not terribly persuasive. But I was saying, you know, there are views in the West. And one of them said, well, you know, we have similar views about the West. We think the West treats poor people incredibly badly in a capitalist system. We think that whole system's mad. Well, I tend to agree with them, frankly. So, you know, there's just a disconnect, and we need to start looking for points of agreement instead of points of disagreement. And we need to help the Afghan government. They're doing okay economically. They're given all the sanctions. They're doing better than Pakistan. But we need to help reintegrate them into the world society instead of just sanctioning them and telling all of them they're evil.
I mean, you've been to Afghanistan. Is there a space to foster some form of civil society connections between, say, British people and
Afghanistan? Oh, huge opportunity. I was planning, I don't think I'll get it done this time, but I was planning on taking a cricket team out there. Oh, they're mad about cricket. I love this. I'm mad about cricket, right? And everywhere you go, I was there in, you know, when was it? February. It was minus 13 degrees. And they were playing cricket everywhere in the snow. I mean, I admire that. And I think it's really important for us to reach out. One of my Guantanamo clients was the founder of the Afghan Cricket Association.
Right.
And yeah, they've had cricket teams, men's and women's, and they're great. And they beat England in the World Cup. So I think there are ways that we can really reach out to people as human beings and then let everyone come and see the Afghanistan that I saw and then engage in ways that will make things better for everyone.
So back to Dr. Afia's case. Now, as you know, our viewers are more than ready to help in any way they can. And I think the majority of Muslims that I speak to, and actually wider non-Muslims who care about this case, majority of us really don't know where to help, how to help. Can you summarize what help you still require legally, funding-wise, what help you require, and how can the ordinary, I know you contested that term the last time we met, but how can the ordinary person help you and help Afia make a difference here?
Well, I dare say I would say that everyone has talents that makes them extraordinary, and I can abuse anyone's talents. That'd be great. Yeah. No, look, there are basically three or four areas. First, please do continue to send her letters of encouragement and make them detailed. Don't make them one line. make him why you're inspired by what she's gone through, because that really helps her. And it really helps her to know that people on the outside know who she is, care about her, and lionize her. I mean, I think that's really good for her.
Yeah.
Second,
did she know that before these lectures?
No, she had no idea. She thought she was totally forgotten.
Really?
And so that's fabulous. And I think of all the things I've achieved thus far, that's probably number one in my view.
Yeah.
The second issue is that we do need help. We need particular help in reaching the echelons of power in America and in Pakistan.
Yeah.
To convince them to go ahead with a swap come November or something like that, or at least to show compassion. We need, I need some help, goodness knows. I mean, I've currently been blacklisted by these funding organizations for representing Afia because they think there's something criminal about going to Afghanistan. That's annoying. And you know, I'm going to America and I'm going to hire an investigator, for example, who has experience in areas that I can't reach. You know, he was actually a soldier in Afghanistan in Bagram at the time of all of this. He knows all of those people. I need that help. It's going to cost $20,000. So I need to raise some funds for that. Right now it's difficult because I can't do a crowdfunding. But, you know, I got PayPal on my website. If anyone wants to donate, I'd be very grateful.
But if there is a high net worth individual who wants to cover some or all of that cost, how do they reach out to you?
Oh, well, then just give them my email. I'd be glad to tell them what my charity, my nonprofit bank account is. I'd be very grateful.
Yeah.
But I don't want people to think that that's going to stand between me and getting the job done. I'm going to do it regardless.
Yes.
Then we need experts. I need legal help from lawyers in America because this is much bigger than I had thought, and it's much bigger than I, standing alone, can handle.
Right.
In the sense that we need to sue the prison to make the prison behave better. We need to sue them to get the imams in, to get the doctors in. We need to do all sorts of what I would view as collateral litigation to improve her situation. I need, you know, preferably people who are really committed, who are sort of Pakistan-American lawyers or from big firms who can help me do that sort of litigation. I can do all the regular stuff that I'm used to in terms of litigating her conviction and sentence in New York.
Yeah.
So all of that help is useful. I need doctors.
Where do they have to be situated in the U.S.?
Ideally Texas, but Washington and New York work too. And, you know, I've worked for my entire career with pro bono law firms who have massive resources and who are able to help me outgun the government so that we can get some justice for her. So, you know, that sort of help would be incredibly helpful and so on and so forth. There's really no limit.
Right. You were about to say there's another, I cut you short. There was something else you were about to
say. Well, I mean, look, there are things like what you're doing. And I'm grateful to you for doing this program because we need media coverage. I'm going to take a film crew to Afghanistan next time because we need to get coverage out there to begin to put some pressure on, particularly still the reticent parts of the Pakistan high command. Because there is people there who won't talk to me, I wish they would, who are trying to thwart our efforts to get Afia home. And I've got this message for them. It's the same message I've always given to governments for my Guantanamo clients. I want to work with you to make this work out well, and we'll give credit to the people who help get her out, and everything will be good. If that doesn't happen, I've only got one option, which is to expose the torture that she went through and who was behind it. I don't want to do that. It doesn't achieve anything for anyone. But I need the people who are paranoid about that to cooperate, because otherwise we can't get her home.
Well, I suppose one reason why they continue to incarcerate us is she would be a problem for them if she was outside talking. I mean, how do you square that?
So that's easy. I mean, she's not going to be. She is so traumatized. Yeah, look at her son and daughter who are home and have been for years.
Yeah.
Those kids, they're getting on with their life, and I have great admiration for them, but they won't talk about what happened, partly because they're intimidated, but partly because they're just totally traumatized. Now, Afia is so traumatized that she just needs to be in hospital, and she needs to be getting the help she needs, and she needs to be never heard from again in that sense. And I think we can pretty much guarantee that. That's not going to be an issue. But on the other hand, if this continues, the only option I've got is to publicize everything I find out. And that's just not going to be good for the people who are behind him.
And we don't know anything else about Suleiman and his whereabouts, whether he's dead or not.
We don't know. And it's interesting to ask people about this. I mean, you know, you've got kids, Lon. So if one of them, if you weren't sure if your son was alive or dead, which would be worse?
Yeah.
To know that your child's dead or to just not be sure?
Yeah.
And I think it's the not being sure that is so difficult. So I wish someone would just tell us what happened. You know, we're not going to sue them or persecute them. We just need to know for the family's sake.
Can I ask you about Mazen Bek? So you went
definitely.
To Afghanistan with Mazen, and he was detained at the airport when he returned under Section Schedule 7, is it?
Mm-hmm.
But also more broadly, there's been, you've noticed in the last week, Michael Gove has announced this extremism label and definition or redefinition that's come out of his government. Mazen and Cage, his organization, are implicated in, they're probably Exhibit A from Michael Gove's perspective. You know, they encapsulate this Islamist extremism that the government is trying to fight. I mean, what's your comment on all of that?
Well, first, Michael Gove's definition of extremism, one of the red flag indicators is that you exhibit socialist thoughts. Well, I'm absolutely guilty of that. And if they want to lock me up, you know, put me in handcuffs right now.
Yes.
It's just madness, right? I was reading The Guardian on Thursday, and there I'm quoted, and I didn't realize I'd talked to him. I hadn't talked to him. But I'm quoted as saying that I think Cage and Mazen Bek play a vital role in the human rights work. Well, I don't remember when I said that. It's true. I'll say it over and over again. I didn't realize that what really shocked me was the context, was that they were saying that my friend and colleague, Mazen Bek, is somehow an extremist. Now, Michael Gove was once Secretary of Education, Minister, and so he should know that the word prejudice comes from the Latin prejudice, and it means prejudgment when you don't know any facts. He's accusing Mazen Bek of being prejudiced in some extremist way, which is total nonsense. But Michael Gove is prejudiced. He's never bothered to meet Mazen Bek. He didn't bother to talk to him before he tarred him in the media. And he did it in a coward's way. He did it under parliamentary privilege where he can say it without being sued. So I got two challenges for Mr. Gove. The first and by far the best one would be if he agrees to meet with me and Mazen in person so he can meet Mazen. Because when I did that with the former Chief Justice, now sadly dead, Tom Bingham, Lord Bingham met Mazen and heard what a reasonable person he is and how he's about reconciliation and forgiveness, notwithstanding all the awful things he went through in Guantanamo. Lord Bingham said to Mazen, "I didn't realize there were people like you in Guantanamo Bay." And, you know, he had a lot of respect for Mazen, which was great, and it's as it should be, and I have a lot of respect for Mazen. So if Gove wants to meet with Mazen, I'm happy to facilitate it. He can then change his view. The alternative is he can get up and not be a coward and say what he said in public and let us sue him, because these people need to be taught a lesson that they can't go around just slandering people and think that they can get away with it. My job is to protect the powerless against the powerful, and I don't like powerful people doing what Gove did to Mazen Bek. So I wrote a letter to The Guardian just today on the train coming to see you, saying just this, that I would challenge him to meet with us and make his own judgment based not on ignorance but on fact. And if he does that, he'll realize that Mosim is the person I know who is a profoundly decent human being.
Finally, Clive, when I last spoke to you, you were quite optimistic about Afia's case and that she would be released. I mean, have you assessed or reassessed that based on your engagements at Fort Worth? I mean,
what sort of person do you think I am? You think I'm not a pathetic optimist under any circumstance? No, I haven't reassessed it.
Really?
We're going to get justice for Afia. The only question is how long it's going to take. I do see it as a big battle.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we can approach this as if it's a system that works. It's not a system that works. We have to approach it in terms of the leverage we can bring to bear on her behalf in order to get her some form of justice.
Okay, thank you. And so your immediate asks are we need to raise $20,000 for Afia's case, and
we need to raise quite a lot more than that, actually. Yeah. There's lots of other costs, but that's just the investigation in America.
And we need a team of lawyers in America to help you with her case.
Most important and easiest is for your listeners and viewers to send me letters at the address I'll give you. It's the one that works best is clivestaffordsmith2020@gmail.com.
Great.
That's my personal one, and that'll always work, hopefully.
Clive, I'm grateful for your time today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels, and head over to our website, thinkingmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.